If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
Thinking big thoughts. So you don't have to.
We do.
Here's John Williams.
Doesn't always work out, but Lord knows we try. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We're here until 3 o'clock on the John Williams Show. Hi, this is John. Saturdays, tune in to 10 a.m. till 12 noon to hear me. And remember, we are the Mincing Rascals, judge the best podcast in the city of Chicago. The Mincing Rascals is me. It's that Steve Bertrand guy you hear doing the news and the noontime Wintrust Business Lunch. And then, of course, we are joined by some of our friends at the Chicago Tribune, Eric Zorin, Scott Stantis, the editorial cartoonist, Kristen McQuarrie writes editorials and sometimes a column, and sometimes Patty Vasquez and Justin Kaufman join us from WGN Radio. That group of guys and gals all talk about stories in the news, and it's called The Mincing Rascals. It's a free podcast. Get it wherever you get finer podcasts and enjoy what is the Lissagor Award winner for the best podcast in the city. On social media, WGN King John. We'll post a new news click. We asked you yesterday, after game one, how did you feel about the Bears so far this year? And it was split about a third, a third, a third between crushed but optimistic, crushed but not sure, or just plain crushed. You can get one last vote in at WGNradio.com or on my Facebook page. That's our daily web poll question, the news click. How do you feel about the Bears now, brown cow? It's funny because that is still a big story in the Sun-Times and Tribune, too. This city is still reeling on the heels of the Bears-Packers game. Today is, of course, the 11th of September, and just speaking of thinking about and reflecting, we had this conversation in the office yesterday, off the air, that isn't it funny that 9/11 can sneak up on you now? Steve made a good point with Bill and Wendy earlier today when he said that, well, you know, you have more and more people each year who do not remember it. They either weren't born or they were so young that it was not impactful, right? What's the age of recollection and reason for you? 7 or something? So if you're 24, that was not a reality in your life. And if you were even a little older, maybe it wasn't so worrisome. So I get that, but I'm not that, and it kind of sneaks up on me these days. Are you like me, too, in that when the 11th of September is as beautiful as it is today, cool and clear, and the skies are that autumnal blue, and it's such a lovely day, it makes you melancholy because this is what it was like that day? I always associate a fall day like this with the 11th of September. It was that way here in Chicago. It was that way in New York. I don't remember what it was like in D.C. and Pennsylvania that day, but I get a little sad when I think about what it should be just a lovely day weather-wise. And then we sometimes think about where were we on that day? Do you remember where you were? I've always felt that those conversations are a little lazy from a talk or journalism standpoint, but actually I could be persuaded otherwise. Especially since as the years go on and we start to forget a little bit about it, maybe we should pause and say, where were you? What were you thinking? I remember that when the first building was struck, I thought, oh my God, that's terrible. I didn't know it was a commercial airliner, but you heard about that. And then you heard it was a commercial airliner. And then you heard it was a second airliner. And you went, okay, that's not a coincidence. Something's up. But you still didn't know what. I did not get the sense of doom, however, until the third or fourth planes, because then you knew it was coordinated. Then you knew we were going to war with somebody, and you knew that life would thereafter after always be different. From fighting enemies we can't see to taking off your shoes at the airport, things we could not anticipate. The late and great Paul Green said on this radio station, 24 hours after the fact, no, with that day, he said, life will be different at the airports now. And boy, could he not have been more correct. But I think about the weather that day when I think about 9/11. I think about the doom I felt when the third or fourth plane struck because I thought, this isn't a singular incident. This isn't a group of people. It is a state-sponsored thing, or it's a military. We are under war now, and they said all planes are now being grounded. Nobody is flying. I'll never forget that. Within 36 hours, you had armed guards on street corners in Chicago. Do you remember how bizarre that was? Of course, the problem for us today is, so then what's a reasonable takeaway? We should remember this stuff, but what should we also learn, know, or do as a result, besides remembering them? And incidentally, the fact that the president didn't tweet about this first thing in the morning goes under the category of that doesn't matter. I'm the great keeper of does it matter or not? That does not matter, because it is about that president. So in the words of Serena Williams, let's not boo anymore. The president has put out a half a dozen tweets about 9/11 today. It wasn't first on his mind. It's not foremost on his mind. That's the man that's in office. What are you going to do?
You know, I like that he didn't tweet first because I don't care about his tweets. It's almost the day is, like you said, bigger than him. So he would have almost potentially ruined the beginning of the day.
Well, he kind of did. Because he didn't tweet about that first, and that's the first thing the national media seized on. Steve Cochran was talking about that this morning. It was a great interview with the guy before 8 o'clock from, what was the source? But they were just talking about Donald Trump, and they were mentioning the fact that, you know, Maggie Haberman from the New York Times wrote about that first thing. Joe Scarborough, did you catch Scarborough, Steve, this morning talking about this?
I didn't hear him talking about that. No, I didn't. No, I missed that. What is it that he tweeted? What did he tweet about first?
I'll pull it up here for you. But the Department of Justice isn't doing a good job.
Oh,
you know, just the usual stuff.
You know, I had the same thought. I was watching him in the background as he's sitting behind all the other speakers at Shanksville.
Yeah.
And he looked...
Not engaged.
Not engaged. Saying that's a very good way to put it. And that's just who he is. That's what you're not going to get engagement at this point. It's like expecting eloquence from George W., you know, he's good in a lot of ways. He's not good in a lot of other ways, but he's just not going to be eloquent.
Right. So there's two things that I would want the president to be. One is, you know, first and foremost, focused on this. Maybe dial back all communication a little bit. Stop worrying about the investigation against you. Just for a moment, give us a break. But he didn't do that. But also, if somebody had written something eloquent for him, you know that it's not the way Trump speaks when he's speaking extemporaneously, when he's tweeting extemporaneously. His verbiage doesn't lend itself to that sort of thing anyway. It's just not his strong suit. He can do a rally. It would feel artificial if he were saying something moving and eloquent now. That's not a shot against the president. It may sound like it, but that's just not his forte, right? Some presidents and public speakers do boring rallies. That's Donald Trump's strong suit. Some people are more...
off the cuff.
Well, some people off the cuff are a little more relatable. The word will come to me in a second, but that's just not Donald Trump's strong suit. A couple of your quick calls. We'll take a break. There's one other thing I just wanted to mention about 9/11, and that is when you do think about it today, you probably also, like me, play back some of those iconic images of the plane about to hit the building, the hole in the side of the building, the whitewashed people who are now covered with the pulverized remains of the buildings, walking away like zombies or ghosts. You remember those images. The most disturbing of them all for me is the tight image of a man falling from the building as he plummets down the side of it. And the man who took that picture is going to visit with us in just a couple of minutes. Dave, you're on WGN Radio. What did you want to say? You're on the air.
Yeah, we would always remember I had two people on our department that had family members. One was on one of the planes, and one was actually a shore officer in building when one of them collapsed. So we always remember the fire department has always had the pictures of all the firemen on their wall, and they had a ceremony in front of the firehouse again today. So, I mean, we will always remember and not forget. And we were just talking about this morning, where were we on that day? I was at work, my wife was at work, and all of a sudden everybody in her hospital came down, and they're all like 100 people trying to get around one TV to see what was going on.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. We, for a few years there, were very, very cognizant of how police officers and firefighters are ready to put themselves in harm's way. They will run towards the collapsing buildings while we run from them. And we were really good about that for a while. I don't remember the last time, though, somebody patted those guys on the back and said thank you in advance for who knows what. But maybe we should remember to do that today, huh?
Well, we probably should say thank you every day because, as you said, we're the ones that run toward things to try and fix things, and as the other people are leaving.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, I appreciate you listening. My best to all your friends over there, Dave.
Have a good day.
Thanks for the call from 847. King John, I was a newlywed on 9/11. I share your reaction to a sunny, crisp fall day, the juxtaposition of such beauty and ugliness all at the same time. How well put, 847. That's it. It's so weird, but on a beautiful fall day, when it happens on the 11th of September, I'm so melancholy, right? You go, what a lovely day. Oh, crap, that reminds me of 9/11. Is there a podcast of the couple of hours on WGN as the events unfolded? I learned about it from listening to WGN radio. I turned on my TV muted to see the images, but I listened to you guys. Thank you, 630. I don't know that we have that up. A year later, I did a one-hour special where we took the 24 hours from impact forward. So we took the 24 hours of this radio station, a lot of which was just national television coverage, but also local radio coverage, and we sort of scrunched that down into an hour.
I'm sorry, John.
And you sort of get the play-by-play of that day.
I would love to hear again the raw, because I was sitting next, Tom Peterson was anchoring, and I was sitting next to him.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where I had my ears on the different ABC channels, and we would just go back and forth. And I remember telling him, he's on the air, and I don't know if I mouthed the words or just said them quietly, but I said, every plane in the U.S. is setting down. And, you know, that was just one of those real moments from that morning when he went on the air and said, you know, every plane around the country is landing somewhere now at their closest airport.
You know, one of my recollections, too, I remember Tom's coverage that day. He and Spike Odell were, you know, hesitant to overplay it, but, oh, my God, this looks really bad. And, you know, moment by moment, we got the gravity of it. But I'll never forget, too, I believe it was Peter Jennings, but he was on the phone with one of the reporters at the scene, and he said, what's happening now? And he said, well, the buildings come down. And Peter Jennings said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, the buildings collapse. And he said, you mean part of it? Or, you know, he refused to accept, could not believe that the building had fallen onto itself all the way down to the ground. He just had to be walked through that fact, as did we all, huh? It's 1:20. One of the iconic photos from that day, the photographer who took it, joins us in a minute. WGN Radio's web producer is Dave Marzullo. Hey, Dave, what's up?
I just heard you discussing the 9/11 question that
retrospective that we did.
Right. We have actually on the front page of WGNRadio.com, we have audio from that day. We have your special that you did a year later. We have a number of other things. We have Milt Rosenberg from that evening. We have you talking with Blair Kamen from that afternoon about the towers. We have, I believe, the segment with when you talked
Carol Marine.
Carol Marine.
Oh my gosh!
So,
she nearly lost her life. The building collapsed. There was a shroom of debris. A firefighter pulled her out of the way as the debris was falling. She hasn't spoke about that much since. She doesn't want to talk about it.
Right.
You've got all that on our front page.
It's,
huh?
It's called Remembering 9/11. It's on the front page of WGNRadio.com.
Dave Marzullo is our web producer. Thanks, Dave. The iconic photo called Falling Man was shot by an AP photographer named Richard Drew. Richard, this is John Williams, and you're on WGN Radio. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing today? I've been listening to the show. Very interesting.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for your work. What's today like for you? That's maybe the photograph of that day.
Somebody's trying to call me in the other line, but I'm sure they'll go away. Go ahead.
If you need to address that, I'll let you, but we hear you fine, sir. What is a 9/11 like for you these years?
Every year it comes around again. Like this year, for example, is very much like it was 17 years ago. I was covering a fashion show, and when I got a phone call from my office and said, a plane is at the World Trade Center, you have to go. I was covering a Oscar de la Renta fashion show this morning.
So did you know what you were going to cover when they said leave the fashion show?
Yeah, they said a plane's hit the World Trade Center, bagged the fashion show, you have to go. And at that time, our fashion week was at Bryant Park. And if you're familiar with Manhattan, it's sort of in the middle of Manhattan at 42nd Street and 6th Avenue. And so I walked a block over to Times Square with my equipment, of course, and got on a southbound subway train. And that time, the trains were running and they hadn't shut them off yet. So I go. Being a good photographer, I didn't, or should I say a smart photographer, I didn't ride all the way into the World Trade Center. I got off a stop before and came up and saw that both of the towers were on fire. And I thought, wow, that was some airplane. And I didn't know until a while later when I was talking to a police officer when he said he was there when the second plane hit. That's when I knew that there were two that had been an attack. So the second plane hit while I was in the subway.
Describe the photo, Falling Man.
Well, it's been described recently by Elton John, as he calls it, the most perfect photo ever taken. He's a big avid photo collector, and he actually bought a copy of it and had me autograph it for him, and he has it framed. He was interviewed on a TV show, a national TV show, and that's how I happened to see it. It's a picture of a man falling headfirst. From the World Trade Center, and he sort of bisects both of the World Trade Center, so he's sort of in the middle. And I like to say that I didn't take the picture. It's one of, I believe, 9 or 10 photos of him falling, and the camera happened to cycle during the, like, with what we call a motor drive in the sequence. It cycled right when he was in that position. I didn't see it in that way until I got back to the office after a long walk, because the subways had been shut off, and I saw it, and it's just sort of leapt off the screen. Pardon me for saying that, but it sort of leapt off the screen at me looking at the symmetry of it.
Yeah. Did you know, though, that somebody was falling? Did you at least look for him in your viewfinder when you were taking that picture?
Well, I was standing at West and Vesey Streets on the west side of the World Trade Centers. I was standing between, the police officer and a woman EMT. And one of them, I believe it was the woman EMT, said, "Oh, look up and look at that." And we saw many people coming down. And I just instinctively, being a news person, started photographing the people falling from the building. So he's not the only one I photographed.
Yeah. Do we know, were they falling accidentally, or was the heat just so unbearable they were choosing to jump?
No one knows, and the official thing is they died from being at the World Trade Center. They can't say whether they jumped or whether they fell, you know, whether they decided that was, they had flames licking at their ass, you know, so that was a tough decision.
Think about that. That's just how unbearable it was there that most likely these people thought this was a better course.
Yeah, yeah.
Do we know who that man is?
In the article and in the subsequent documentary that was made from The Falling Man, he's been tentatively identified as either Norberto Hernandez, who was a kitchen worker at the World Trade Center, and it was his last day working there. And it could be Jonathan Briley, who was an audiovisual technician at the Windows in the World, up at the World Trade Center, up at the top. So it could have been either one of those two people. And recently, I was walking around by the reflecting pools, and I was looking at the names again. And I looked over, and I saw Norberto Hernandez's name there, and then one name. Separates he and Jonathan Briley. I had never noticed it before about a month ago when I was walking around down there. Hmm. It happens to be right across the street from our office building now. We've moved down to right across the street from Ground Zero.
Richard Drew is the photographer of the iconic.
I see it every day I go to the office,
Falling Man photograph, for which he won the 93 Pulitzer Prize. One last question.
I won the 93 Pulitzer Prize for a picture of it was a part of our election coverage of the 92 campaign, and it was a picture of Ross Perot making a big guffaw smile. It was part of a part of an entry.
I'm looking at that. Okay, fine. Yeah, I see that now. Pardon me, but not that this matters. This is so trivial, but I'm curious now. That was not submitted? That was not a recipient of a Pulitzer Prize for journalism or photography?
I don't see, because I don't submit them. My office does, the AP does, and I don't know whether it was included in our entry for that year. The New York Times won the Pulitzer for spot news and for feature photography for that year. That included the September 11th attacks. They won it for their World Trade Center coverage and also the war.
Lastly,
in two separate categories.
Richard, just
yes, sir.
So, tell me something about that photograph, and maybe what we should remember today.
Well, I like to think of it. Everybody says it's a disturbing night. A lot of people say it's a disturbing photograph, and it's a very quiet photograph. It doesn't show any mayhem. It doesn't show any buildings collapsing. It just shows it's a very quiet moment and showing it puts a human look at this tragedy. We see the buildings falling, we see the airplanes hitting, but we don't get to see the human element about it. And I think this brings the human element in, and that people look at it and they think that could be me, and I might have to make that decision.
Yeah, that's interesting. Though,
if I could put a plug in for something else here before we leave, that on November 4th, I'm going to be speaking at the Milwaukee Public Library about my career at the AP, and a little more in depth about September 11th.
Milwaukee Public Library, November 4th. That's an hour away. It's just up the road from Chicago.
Yes, sir. At 2:00. So. In their big auditorium. I hope there's going to be a lot of people, but I hear it seats 700 people. I've never spoken before that big a crowd before, except for today, right now.
Yeah, no kidding. November 4th, Milwaukee Public Library. Richard Drew,
yes,
the photographer of The Falling Man. Thanks for your time, Richard.
You're welcome, sir, anytime. Thank you.
Tom Skilling, how are you?
Good, John. How are you?
I'm terrific. Is there any chance that this Category 4 Florence hurricane bearing down on the southeast coast is going to turn or slacken up? That happens sometimes. They're always saying Category 4 or whatever, and it's going to be terrible. And then so often it seems storms aren't as bad as they appear to be a day before they hit. What's your sort of forecast for this hurricane?
Well, there seems to be nothing to inhibit its intensity. Nor to interfere terribly with its track. I mean, we've had 5 days of models essentially taking it on the same track, and that is one that heads it toward the Carolinas. It's over in a no-shear zone, over warm water, and will be. It'll start right as it approaches the coast to be sheared a little bit, and will upwell some cooler water. So the thinking, John, in practical terms, is that this thing will oscillate between Cat 4 and Cat 5. In other words, its winds will be between 140 and 155 miles per hour through tomorrow. And then as it gets ready to landfall, it might go down to a Cat 3. But that's still a major storm. This thing is really going to be offer them a devastating blow. The storm surge is particularly harsh in that area. The continental shelf goes out 50 miles. And in that region of the United States, the water's shallow. It's only 125 feet deep at most in that 50 miles. So when a hurricane comes in, its winds pile up the water very quickly and efficiently. And therefore, the history of storms of comparable strength like Hugo and Hazel are that they produce storm surges that go up to 15 to 20 feet, which is devastating. I think about raising the level of Lake Michigan 15 to 20 feet. Then putting 20 to 25 foot waves at the shoreline on top of it, those waves will be up to 50 feet offshore. And then on top of that, dump 20 to 25 inches of rain and have the storm, once it's ashore, slow down. This has all the earmarks of becoming the Hurricane Hazel of 2018, the hurricane, the one that hit. I'm sorry?
No, go ahead. Keep going.
Yeah, it's comparable to the storm that hit Houston last year in that sense. And by the way, studies of how these tropical cyclones are behaving in this warming atmosphere, this warming environment, is that they slow down and they tend to have more water to work with because the atmosphere in which they're occurring is warmer and holds more water. And so just as happened last year in Houston, that storm stalled and essentially was over the same area for days. This one may do the same thing once ashore.
Mm.
So it comes in with a whole set of hazards, storm surge that could be near record levels, rains that could be near record levels in an area that already has had a lot of rain and then in which the soils are saturated already. And it may sit there for days. And then on top of that, you blast the coastline with waves and high tides. So, you know, that's a bad picture. Anybody in these barrier islands, you know, these hold-ons that tend to ignore the warnings and decide they're going to ride the storm out, they're going to be in some serious trouble if they don't follow the evacuation orders that are out for this storm in those barrier islands up and down the Carolinas.
Speaking of...
So it's a mean storm, John.
Wow. By the way, speaking of
that...
To put
it in historic perspective,
yeah?
There have only been three Category 4 storms that have hit the U.S. coastline from South Carolina northward. This one may actually hit the coastline if it were to get ashore as a hurricane, a Category 4. In other words, if it had 140-mile-per-hour winds at landfall, and it may fall just short of that by the time it reaches landfall, but you're going to hear reports out over the open waters of 150-mile-an-hour winds in this thing in the next couple of days. If it were to go ashore as a Cat 4, it would be the most northerly landfalling hurricane of this intensity to ever occur on the U.S. coastline since 1851. And we've got pretty good records of hurricane landfalls on the U.S. coastline going back that far. So this thing is in a category all by itself and ranks up there with Hugo, and many of us will remember that. That's the one that went ashore close to Charleston, Hilton Head Island, areas like that. And those cities were spared its full brunt because the center went onshore just north of there. And the way the winds blow around a hurricane, the winds were offshore in those locations, but they were onshore up in North Carolina. And that's where you really pile the water up and get the storm surge. So these folks out east are facing quite a storm.
One last quick question from Tom on line one. What was your question, Tom? You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Tom, I just wanted to know, my wife and I are supposed to fly to Charleston, South Carolina on Saturday. Should we cancel?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd give this a chance. Look, Charleston may, if the track is right, escape the full storm surge. But this thing's going to park out there, and so, you know, there are going to be rains running through that area through the weekend and perhaps into early next week. So I don't think it'd be the kind of place I'd want to go for vacation, you know, at that. I think I would definitely call that one off for now.
Okay, Tom, good luck to you. Thanks for the call. And Tom Skilling, you know, there's a climate scientist over at Northwestern said climate change these days or a warmer climate is not going to make more storms, but when we get them, they're going to be more violent. And that's
absolutely
what it sounds like we've got here.
Oh, there's no question. You know, a lot of people have the false impression that climate scientists have been telling them there'll be more storms. Not at all. The thinking is the storms that occur will be stronger. And by the way, that's a trend that's been observed, John. So it's already happening. And Harvey last year in Houston, I'm fumbling for that name.
Yeah.
Hurricane Harvey last year in Houston, you know, that dropped 35 trillion gallons of water on that city. That's like multiple days of the water that goes over Niagara Falls. It all fell on that city. And, of course, they haven't been very prudent in the way they planned that city. So they built in floodplains and everything else. And it was a disaster. And they're still recovering from it down there in the Houston area. So this thing, you know, the only thing you can say positive about this up to this point is at least we don't have a Houston-sized city in the area this is going to go ashore. But the heavy rains from this could extend up to Washington, D.C., Baltimore, and areas like that. So they may get in on some of this as well.
Hurricane Florence is a Category 4 right now, and a Category 6 scientist is Tom Skilling. Category 6 scientist.
Yeah. You know, there's a debate about that, John, whether we ought to do a Category 6. And there are a lot of pros and cons that people throw around on that. I don't think it's a bad idea, frankly. But We may have, you know, there are limits to the wind speed these storms can produce because there's a certain amount of frictional drag that the winds bring to bear on the ocean and the waves they produce. So there's kind of a top limit of where they will go. It should be noted that with sustained winds of 140, 150 miles an hour, you can still get open sea gusts up to 170, 180 miles an hour out over the ocean.
John,
and you wouldn't want to.
Tom, John, and I were talking.
Be an ocean liner in that.
Yeah, no kidding. Wow. What, Steve?
I was just going to say, John and I were talking about situational drag yesterday, so we know exactly. We're very familiar with that.
We were not. All right. I know you're busy, Tom. I know you got a lot of charts and maps.
Oh,
and,
John, I'll tell you, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
You are more than welcome. Thanks, John. Good to talk to you. Take care, Steve.
See you, Tommy.
Hey, Kevin.
John, how are you?
Good. This is Kevin McDonough. He works at WGN Radio. Am I right about that?
That is correct. I'm the traveling Queen of Hearts correspondent for the John Williams Show, as well as a sales consultant.
That's what I told him. I said, you are the Queen of Hearts correspondent for WGN, because what was the place on the south side that you were buying the tickets and talking to us about?
That was McNally's,
yeah.
And I take it you didn't win.
You need to pull that Juice Newton song every time Kevin comes on to play.
The Queen of Hearts.
Yeah.
Anyway, so now, but, you know, when that thing was going on, the one in McHenry County was even higher. That one in McHenry County has still not hit. Tonight's the drawing. How much is it at, Kevin?
So it's over $6 million for tonight's drawing at 7 p.m.
And how many cards are up on the board?
So there's 8 cards remaining.
Okay, so that means that there's a 1 in 8 chance that the person that plays tonight will win the $6 million?
Yeah, if you get your ticket pulled, yeah. You got a 1 in 8 chance of hitting. And now, the winner of this one at the McHenry VFW is actually going to get 60% of the pot. And they estimated after, you know, state and federal taxes, that winner is going to pull in $2.4
million. $2.4 million. Now, you're starting to, now you got a funny line here, but $2.4 million. And then I also read that of the $6 million, some goes to the VFW, some goes to the winner, they're going to pull a million to the side and use that to seed the next pot. So the next day, it's back up to a million with the new drawing, right?
Yeah, they're going to put 20% of the pot back into a new drawing, which will then start up again on January 8th. So they're already looking ahead to get this going. And you know what's interesting? They announced...
Hold on, buddy. We'll finish this conversation after the news. There's something going on the phone line. Kevin is on his way to the VFW in McHenry for that $6.2 million drawing. The Queen of Hearts is there tonight, and they want to get this over. In fact, if they don't have a winner tonight, next week, Tuesday night, they're going to just keep drawing until they do have a winner, because it's all they can do to keep up with the people coming in and buying tickets.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Hi, it's me. This is John Williams. We are in the Allstate Skyline Studio until 3.
Lord have mercy.
Saturdays, we're here from 10 a.m. until 12 noon on social media. I'm WGN King John, Facebook and so on and so forth. Look for us there, play along, and don't forget the Mincing Rascals. The Mincing Rascals is the podcast that we post on Thursdays. Today is the 11th of September. We started the show talking a little bit about that and how our recollections have changed and stayed the same, and how melancholy so many of us get when we see a crisp, beautiful, blue-skied fall day like this. The prettiest days in September remind me of 9/11, and I still have that sad feeling. Not the exact feeling. That was tragic what you were feeling 17 years ago. But when it's a beautiful day like this in September, I go, oh, this reminds me of 9/11. And that puts it in some sort of perspective for me. Again, if you go to the Remembering 9/11 link at WGNradio.com. You'll be able to see some of our coverage and hear some of our coverage that day. Some of the text includes these. Hey, John, it's amazing how many September 11ths look like this. John, on the 11th of September, I hear Tom Peterson's voice breaking into the Spike Odell show. John, the thing about 9/11, one thing that they got me was the people in the hospital emergency room standing around waiting for casualties that never came. I remember that, too. I remember that, too, that you thought, oh, my God, we'll all give blood. Everybody go to the hospital. The emergency room techs were all called in. Not many patients arrived. John, I remember the most about my the thing I remember most about 9/11 was concern for my children in grade school. I didn't know whether to get them or to wait it out. I also remember going home and putting up our American flag. It was so important to me to support my country. I never felt so patriotic. John, I'm still moved to tears on this day. We can never forget. John, if I remember correctly, the White Sox were in New York that day to play the Yankees. John, my TV was on but muted, and my first grader had just gotten on the school bus. I saw the images of the plane hitting the building, and I thought it was a movie preview. When I turned the volume on, they showed the image again. My first reaction was to pick up my son from school and make sure that he and his little brother were both safe at home. So many of you had similar reactions. John, I walked my daughter to school that morning, second grade, went back to our home, and the world changed in those few minutes. It was a beautiful day, and it changed in moments. But so many of you are writing to us just saying that you remember thinking about your kids. And were they away in college or living away from home now or in grade school? My kids were in grade school. And, oh, my gosh, what do I do now? You want to grab them and hug them and hold them? That doesn't make any sense, really, but that's your inclination as a parent. And I think that's a feeling that a lot of us have that comes back on a day like today. We were talking about the hurricane, which is bearing down on North Carolina. Tom Skilling was on with us just a little while ago. And Steve Bertrand was telling you about the amount of rain they might get, 15 inches, 30 inches. Tom said that they'll get over a zillion, trillion, gazillion gallons of water. He said that in Houston, for that last hurricane, 35 trillion gallons of water fell. I don't know how they know that, but let's say that they did. Somebody sent us a text about that and said, hey, John, let me see if I can find this because I want to see if I'm remembering what they wrote correctly. Got all these pages of text here. Hey, John, I wonder if North Carolina's legislators who passed the law in 2012 making it illegal to discuss sea level rise will try to arrest people because of Hurricane Florence. They're talking about this terrible storm surge that's expected. It could be 15 feet high. Imagine wherever you are, a wave 15 feet coming and not leaving for a while. That's what they're about to have happen in North Carolina, potentially. North Carolina legislators passed a law in 2012 making it illegal to discuss sea level rise. So I had producer Elif look that up. Here's what she found. This is ABC News dated August 2, 2012. A new law in North Carolina will ban the state from basing coastal policies on the latest scientific predictions of how much the sea level will rise, prompting environmentalists to accuse the state of disrespecting climate science. The law has put the state in the spotlight for what critics have called nearsightedness and climate change denial, but its proponents said the state needed to put a moratorium on predictions of sea level rise until scientific techniques improve. The law was drafted in response to an estimate by the state's Coastal Resources Commission that the sea level will rise by 39 inches in the next century, prompting fears of costlier home insurance and accusations of anti-development alarmism.
It's like the mayor in Jaws saying, no, there's not a shark. There's no shark around here.
It's going to kill the Labor Day weekend.
Right.
Democratic Governor Bev Perdue had until Thursday to act on the bill, but she decided to let it become law by doing nothing. So she could have vetoed it. She didn't want to sign it. A lot of times, if you just don't want anything after a number of days, it automatically becomes law. That's what she did.
It probably was, I don't know what her legislature's like. She might have been facing an override.
Oh, you're kidding me? Yeah.
So or rather than do that.
Or just political pushback. What, are you not with us on this? Come on, Governor. Stephen Colbert mocked the North Carolina lawmaker's efforts. He joked, if your science gives you a result you don't like, pass a law saying the science is illegal. Problem solved. The law restricts all sea level predictions used to guide state policies for the next 4 years.
So that's government expectations. So government predictions.
Sure. Right. But I mean, let me read that again. The law, which was a routine regulation on development permits, but quickly grew controversial, restricts all sea level predictions used to guide state policies. But what are the policies? Well, they had a projection map that showed land along the coast underwater. And that would mean that many of the planned development projects along the North Carolina coast were in jeopardy, right? Because if the state says, here's our projection of what the state's going to look like in 10, 20, 30 years, and more of it is underwater, that means we need to set aside land for flood zones. That means we need new waste treatment plants that have to be built. Roads have to be elevated. It would cost the state hundreds of millions of dollars to enact the policies or to respect the policies if they said that the water level in North Carolina was going to be higher. The guy who was in charge of the coastal development group that was against the science and for the law that says we're not going to pay attention to the science was a guy named Tom Thompson. And he said, I don't want to say that they're being dishonest. This is my North Carolina accent, by the way.
Oh, it's good. It's really good. Seamless.
I don't want to say that they're being dishonest, but they're pulling data out of their hip pocket, and it ain't working. And it ain't working, he said. Plus, he said he doesn't believe in global warming. And he was the advocate for not making it more difficult to develop roads and subdivisions and malls and buildings. If every time we want to build something, you're going to say, well, there's going to be water there. Right. That doesn't help us. That's not good for economic development.
I mean, think of how different this country is. There's a whole state, a legislature, passing a law saying that, you know, we're just not going to predict the sea levels because we don't want to hear it.
Well, you can. You can predict it all you want, fella, but we're not going to do anything about it. And they set a four-year moratorium on that. Now, that was in 2012, so 2016. So a year and a half, 2 years later, we are today. What the status is of, you know, their attention to sea level rise in North Carolina is now, I don't know. But clearly they lost 4 years of attention to the detail, right? So if the law lapsed yesterday, today you're not prepared. You know, I don't know how long you would need prepare for sea level rise, but...
Well, John, they're not prepared, but did you see those condos? They're very nice.
Whenever stuff like this happens, Brenda and I, we go, suddenly living in Chicago, the worst place in the world to live, right? Terrible weather, violence, taxes, corrupt and inept politicians in Springfield. Who wants to move to Chicago? Here's what you don't have in Chicago. You don't have tornadoes like you do in Tornado Alley. You don't have hurricanes like you do on the coasts. You don't have the heat and the fires that they have out west and in the southwest. You know, I mean, it's not good here for a lot of reasons, but don't you feel insulated from some of the worst of climate change because we're not in those places?
And the only thing we deny are our pension crises.
All right, we don't have money to pay lottery winners, but we don't have storm surges.
We're not pretending there's not climate change.
That's right. I don't know which is a better choice, to be honest with you. Right. Maybe
there should be a state law prohibiting any sort of pension fixes for 4 years.
Because I don't really believe these numbers.
It's pulling them out of their hip pocket.
The state of Illinois has hired a climate scientist from North Carolina to handle the state budget crisis. And he said, you know, first of all, you got your laws wrong. You got to deny. If you deny it, well, then they can't do anything about it. And then, well, then you don't have a problem now, do you, son? I don't know if that sounds like North Carolina. I think I may have swung a little west and got all Texas on.
Make it stop.
All right, I'm done with that. Oh, we've got some phone calls. All right, let's talk to Sharon. You're on WGN Radio. Sharon, thanks for joining us. What can we do for you today? You're on the air.
Well, my husband and I were listening to your program when you were talking to Tom Skilling, and you were mentioning about how many people, like a million people, need to leave the area where Hurricane Florence was coming in. And my husband said, you know what the motels and hotels in Illinois ought to do is offer a discount rate for people fleeing the hurricane. And I thought, there's an idea. If they advertise a discount, that would bring more people into Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
That would also help with taxes to some degree. And I thought, well, it's worth calling the radio station to...
Yeah, I like the sound of that. It's funny, right now we've got a hotel worker strike on, so actually we have not as many rooms as we normally would, but in general I like the attitude. Logistically, you got to get those people here. How are we going to get them all here, Sharon?
Well, I would think that most of them would drive mm-hmm. to get away, and if they have a plan, evacuation plan on the highways, that would be a possibility, too, of moving people.
Yeah. Listen, you not only is your heart in the right place, but I like what your head is doing. Let's figure this out. Sharon, thanks for the phone call. Do you think, and maybe you are a person or know a person that is like this, but the people that decide to stay, they're telling people in North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, depending on the storm track, that they need to get 150 miles away. So figure a two-hour drive. That is, if it were coming into Chicago, everybody would need to get to, say, Peoria or Springfield. You would need to go Peoria and beyond. You would need to go to the Iowa border and beyond. That's how far away they want everybody to go. And a lot of people are. A lot of people aren't. The people who aren't may not be because they don't have the means or the money, and that's very real. I mean, people that didn't leave New Orleans at Katrina sometimes didn't, not because they were ignorant or deniers, but they literally, think about that, did not have a way to get away. It's hard to imagine in this day and age. But I think there's a lot of people that think, okay, this is going to be terrible. It's going to be the thrill ride of my life. I think that 27% of the people, 27%, and by the way, that's a number that I just made up, but I believe I can back it up. I believe 27% of the people are staying because they kind of want to give it a go. They want to see what this is like. They believe that they'll grow another testicle if they do this. It's just either a manly thing or an exciting thing or a thing that sort of calls upon your courage and you're not going to back down. A lot of the people say, well, this is my home. I can't leave my home. A home is a building. You are a person. Home doesn't have a pulse. You do. Leave. If the home's gone, it's not going to be mad at you. You haven't abandoned anything. I just don't understand that. But I think there's a high percentage of the people, reportedly now 27%, who want to stay just because they want to see if they can do it. I really believe that. It's 222. More of your calls coming up. 312-981-7200 is the number. This is WGN. Oh, and get ready for another exciting Blackhawks season. Can you believe that? Here it comes. You can get more details about what we're going to be doing this weekend. They've got the, what do they call it? The Training Camp Festival. The Training Camp Festival. It's going to be this Saturday, and I'm going to be broadcasting from there from 10 a.m. until 12 noon. I'll do my Saturday show from there. They got all kinds of activities and music and beverages, and then you all go inside and watch them skate and practice. Here it comes. Our live broadcast is sponsored by Mathnasium, changing lives through math.
We'll send you to the theater. The hottest show in Chicago is Legally Blonde, the musical.
Oh my God!
We've got free tickets after 5 o'clock.
The Rocon Show with Anna DeBlantis. Up next at 3 on 720 WGN.
What does building a better bank look like? It starts with building Capital One cafes, warm, inviting places that feel nothing like a typical bank, where you can open an account with no fees or minimums in 5 minutes, and you'll always find people ready to help you, not sell you. Welcome to Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet?
For consumers only. Offered by Capital One and a member FDIC. Cafes available in select locations. Copyright 2018 Capital One.
Message and data rates may apply.
Oh, I know. Let's play Bears.
I'll be the mommy. First, she's going to go to work, then learn computer programming, then bring Baby Bear to soccer, then become a photographer, then write a book, then...
The mommy bear can't do all that.
Uh-huh. My mommy does. My mommy can do anything.
With Coursera, there's no limit to what you can do. Coursera partners with great universities to put courses and master's degrees at your fingertips, 100% online, like an MBA from the University of Illinois or a Master of Computer Science from Arizona State University. Discover the degree that's right for you by texting CLIMB to 250250. Applications available now. Get the same degree online, often for as little as half the cost, in a way that fits your work and family life.
Now, Mommy Bear is getting her MBA.
Discover the degree that's right for you by texting CLIMB to 250250. Coursera, your course to success. Text CLIMB to 250250.
I talked to Ken Starr before the show today, read his book last night and this morning, and then we interviewed him. His new book is Contempt, a memoir of the Clinton investigation. There are so many parallels to what's happening today and what he thinks should happen today. Very, very interesting. We'll post the entire 35-minute interview with Ken Starr at WGNradio.com right after the show today. You'll be able to hear it without interruption. We'll broadcast a little bit of it after the 2:30 news and then again tomorrow when we have a little more time. Also, speaking of big-time book writers. Look at that. Steve Cochran is talking to Bill O'Reilly. That Bill O'Reilly's got a new book out. He's on with Steve Cochran at 7:10 tomorrow morning. Tonight, the fight for the Central Division. It's the Brewers in town against the Cubs. Cubs lost last night. It's one game separates them. All the action tonight at 7 on WGN-TV. Don't let knee pain slow you down. Go to that Joint Relief Institute in Orland Park. You've been hearing me, John Williams, talk about how I went there and you should go there, too. But look, this is a commercial. I'm supposed to say that, right? But if you go to their website, jointreliefinstitute.com, they've got videos there, a long video, like 4 minutes, and it's a whole bunch of people telling their stories. Watch that video. I hope you believe me. You should. I'm telling you the truth. I had a great experience there. But look at that letter carrier who said his pain level's down to a 1 or a 2 for the first time in 4 years. Delivering the mail's not painful. The guy that just got back from a vacation, he was able to enjoy. The person who said they sleep at night. The lady who said she walked in and limped in and danced out. All of these first-person stories from the folks at the Joint Relief Institute, where they attack your knee pain. Attack's the wrong word. I mean, they painlessly put a joint lubricant into the spot where your knee is compromised, and it really works. Find out more at jointreliefinstitute.com or call them right now, 708-888-0000, as in zero pain. Kathy, you're on WGN Radio. This is John. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I just recalled this morning as I was driving to my body pump class at the LaGrange Y that 9/11 was also on a Tuesday because I was at Body Pump at the old LaGrange Y that is no longer there.
Thankfully.
And how the world has changed a lot in that way, too. But I remember standing there in class, pumping my barbells and watching. They had big screen TVs because it was a big gym, if you recall, with a track around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had these big screen TVs that there was no sound, of course, but there were like 3 of them, I think, and I was watching, and I just figured it was somebody's review of a movie, and it wasn't until class was over and I got in my car that I realized what had happened. But it's just funny how just driving to class this morning just brought that all back.
Isn't it funny? We all have these little triggers. Kathy, thank you for the call, and I know that why well. That was our why, and I, of course, don't remember that, but we all have little triggers. And to me, a crisp blue autumn day makes me feel a little something that I felt on 9/11. Thanks for the call.
I actually was across the street at my friend's about to go to school from the Y, across the street from the Y.
Oh, no kidding. So what grade were you in at the time?
4th.
And how well do you remember all of this?
I remember a lot of that morning. I remember us taking a moment of silence in school, but I remember mostly just my friend's dad looking really upset and seeing everything unfold on their TV, which was up high. I remember everything about that morning.
I suppose, though, maybe not fair because you were older on 9/11 than I was when Kennedy died. But when Kennedy died, I didn't know nothing. I'm a little tiny little kid. But I remember feeding off the faces of my parents, my mom and the neighbor lady, Mrs. Cordy, and I thought, they're very upset. I've never seen this. This is weird what's going on. So I didn't know what was going on, but I knew mom was having an issue. And that was how I connected with Kennedy's assassination.
Well, and as a little kid, I feel like, as I was at 9/11, you bring back those memories of fear. Like, we looked up, at least I did, I looked up every time I saw a plane downtown, and I was nervous, you know, after that.
Yo, absolutely. We were that way that week.
We thought we were next. We thought you never knew where it was going to stop.
If you saw a plane in the sky, you thought, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute.
You'd watch it until you saw it pass.
John, I remember I was in college and my brother called my dorm and left me a message on my answering machine telling me that we are going to war and he hopes that we don't bring back the draft. I will never forget that message. Hi, John. My son was born 9/10/01, 8:30 p.m. I remember thinking he is born as the world ends. John, I was leaving class at UIC with a nervous view on the Sears Tower. This one says, hey, John, hey, Steve, I thought I remembered the silence in the skies for 4 or 5 days that no planes were allowed to fly. It was so eerie. John, in the 9/11 aftermath, I remember my anger toward my son's high school American history teacher. He refused to discuss current events. I knew that war was inevitable, and sure enough, some of my son's classmates ended up going to Iraq and Afghanistan. John, we were returning from Europe when it was happening. The captain came on and said that there was a terrorist attack in the United States and we couldn't land in Chicago. It was like the Twilight Zone. Thank goodness for Canada. They welcomed us in, blessed them, got home 2 days later. And the list goes on. Thanks for texting all of your and calling all of your thoughts and recollections on 9/11 today. They've been very interesting. We have a Remembering 9/11 tab or page. Go to WGNradio.com and you can see and hear what that day was like and really some just truly remarkable interviews and conversations. You'll hear both in real time what it was like that morning in Chicago, but also some interviews from some people involved who survived afterwards. It's gripping radio, and it's not a bad idea for us to, one way or another, pause and reflect. This texter said, hey, John, I was in Vienna, Austria when it happened. We could not get a flight home. We were stranded there for 3 days. So somber, feeling helpless. We walked to the American embassy, and I was truly stunned by the outpouring of love in the form of flowers and books to sign. I wonder if we would be greeted the same way today. A lot of reflections today coming in. 312-981-7200. So I interviewed Ken Starr just before the show today, and we'll play back some of that conversation here and tomorrow when we have a little more time. But the entire 35-minute conversation or so, he was really generous with his time. I think he gave us more than he was supposed to. It was a very interesting conversation. His new book, Ken Starr of the Clinton Investigation, his new book is titled Contempt, a Memoir of the Clinton Investigation. He's waited this long to finally, Ken Starr, tell his story. You think about people who leave the White House these days, you know, who are connected to a major American political story, they tell the story while they're on their way out the door. Those books hit the next day, right? He's waited until now, Ken Starr, to tell his story for a variety of reasons. But there it is. So it's sort of a trip down bad memory lane. But so much of what he's talking about, and this is one of the reasons he finally did write the book, applies to what's happening right now. And so we'll get to that. But here's just a little bit of a revelation to me. I mean, really, so do you know how the Lewinsky-Clinton investigation went down? Can you connect the dots? You know, I thought I had a handle on it. I always thought that Monica Lewinsky surfaced as the result of the Whitewater investigation, but she didn't. That was a concurrent but separate event. The time that they were investigating the Clintons and the McDougals for $825,000 in mismanaged money in a Arkansas real estate deal, I mean, think about that. $825,000. It's just a pittance, right? $825,000 in a land deal that goes bad. The money's being mishandled. It's criminal what's happening. The FBI is looking into that, and the Clintons say they are silent partners. Okay, whatever, right? But none of that has anything to do with Monica Lewinsky. But the Lewinsky thing surfaces shortly thereafter, but completely separate to that. They are connected, but you talk about losing sleep over some things in your life. Imagine if each night when you went to bed, you had those two things on your mind. It all starts, of course, with Paula Jones. In 1991, Ken Starr reminds us, Paula Jones was working the registration desk at the Arkansas Industrial Development Commission. She's there when you sign in for this little conference in Little Rock. She's making about $6.50 an hour. Bill Clinton is the governor. He's the speaker. He eyes her. And later that afternoon, a state trooper approaches Jones and hands her a four-digit number. He says, this is the room the governor is staying in. He says, don't worry, we do this all the time. And so in that room, she goes up not knowing why. He comes on to her. He exposes himself. He asks her for a sex act. She refuses. She leaves. Bill Clinton, before she leaves, says, let's just keep this between ourselves. You're a smart girl. We don't need to tell anybody about this. But over the next couple of years, he keeps coming on to Paula Jones, usually through surrogates. She goes on, has her life. She gets married, right? When a story was written in the American Spectator by David Brock about Clinton's philandering, a woman was mentioned in his article named Paula. The trooper later told Paula, hey, listen, don't worry about that. You were the woman that was mentioned in that article as being one of Clinton's standby girlfriends, but don't worry, we didn't use your real name. She said, well, first of all, it's not true. I never had sex with him. I wasn't his girlfriend. And B, my friends are going to see that and think that that was me. They'll know who Paula was. So Paula Jones files a lawsuit against the then sitting president of the United States, or he became president. But he is president now, and this is percolating. And she's trying to get this thing through. And here's what she wants. She wants Bill Clinton to apologize. And she wants $175,000 for each incident where she said he acted inappropriately. And that's times four. So she's looking for about $700,000 and an apology from the president. And Ken Starr says, if Clinton had done that, if he had said, I feel terrible about this, I acted inappropriately, he would have found some language and wrote the check. This all goes away. But he doesn't. That's not the way the Clintons rolled. Clinton said, first of all, I think I should be immune from this kind of lawsuit. I'm the sitting president. Where have we heard this before? The president says that I can't be prosecuted while I'm a sitting president for crimes that I may or may not have committed. In this case, it's a civil case. But it should at least be justice delayed. You'll have to at least wait until I get out of office. They take it all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, are you paying attention to this, President Trump? That, in fact, you can be held responsible. We can sue you as a sitting president. And so now this investigation into the Paula Jones case gets going. But it's not Ken Starr's people doing this. Ken Starr's people were looking at the land deal in Whitewater. And it's some other people that are looking into this deal that this woman is suing the president of the United States. The two are connected through Vince Foster. Vince Foster worked with the Clintons. His executive assistant was a woman named Linda Tripp. Oh, Linda Tripp. We remember Linda Tripp. She's the lady that recorded their conversations. So you have Linda Tripp was Vince Foster's executive assistant. The Star team was investigating Vince Foster's death. He committed suicide, they concluded. But that's how you connect the Whitewater investigation into Monica Lewinsky. The Whitewater investigation looks into Foster. Foster gets you to Tripp. Tripp gets you to Monica Lewinsky. And now you've got unlimited resources, right? They've got all the time in the world. They thought they'd be working on this for 6 months. They worked on it for 5 years. And eventually they were able to connect Monica Lewinsky, who was, by the way, however naive and however preyed upon, she was also duplicitous. She was agreeing to say, I mean, she was flat out thinking, we need to protect the president. We need to protect the president. We need to Lie if necessary, but we need to keep this stuff quiet. Lie on affidavits, lie to the FBI, don't tell the truth. And the president was orchestrating some of this. Ken Starr lays it all out in his book. Now, you might not agree with it, you might not like all of it, but this is the prosecutor's recollection of it. And then, as the story's being told, though, so what about the suppression of evidence? What about the promise that you will pardon people even if they perjured themselves, if they do something wrong, just promise that you will pardon them, and then they won't have to go to jail? What do you think? There's so many things that were in play in the Clinton case that we are contemplating in the Donald Trump case. I asked him if he thought that impeachment is down the road for Donald Trump. In fact, what I asked him was, what's your big deal? Okay, so thank you, Ken Starr, for taking us down bad memory lane. But what's the takeaway from your book? What should we know about? And this is what he says.
One of the biggest takeaways is impeachment is hell. I believe that there could have been a different resolution of the William Jefferson Clinton matter through a resolution of censure, and I discussed that at some length. That had been discussed, encouraged by various members of the president's own party. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, then, as now, was bringing her judgment to bear, and she said that, well, I don't think this rises to the level of impeachment. Then the impeachment itself, the process itself, was so rancor-filled. And even though 31 Democrats voted in favor in the House of Representatives, voted in favor of one or more articles, the American people loathe the idea of impeachment. You always hear voices in favor of impeachment. You're hearing them now. One of those similarities, one of those echoes from the past. And I think a lesson in this book, a lesson that the American people have taught us is don't go there. There should be viewed a very powerful, bright yellow warning light, caution light. Be very careful. We want stability in this country. We have elections. We're about to have a midterm election. Let's go through that process. Let's don't keep talking about impeachment. That's a lesson that I drew and I try to articulate in the book.
You don't think there's evidence in the public domain right now that the president has obstructed justice?
No, I do not, because I have a very different view of obstruction of justice than some of the people who I hear in the media. I believe that the President of the United States can fire James Comey, can take other actions, can issue pardons and so forth in the exercise of his power. If Congress views that kind of activity as an abuse of his power, then he can be called to the bar of justice, as it were, in impeachment. But I just think there's no crime, as I see it, in light of the nature, as I see it, of presidential power.
How about that? That's Ken Starr talking a little bit. And he went on at some length, but just a very interesting conversation reflecting both on what happened to Bill Clinton and what does it mean, maybe. So what have we learned and what does it mean about the current president? We'll post that entire conversation just after today's show. It's 2:51 and we're done at 3 on WGN. Ding, 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 ding.
Nicely done.
Nicely done, yeah. Rokan. Mm-hmm.
With the first number.
I'm in charge of all of Mr. Hochberg's compliance.
Oh, boy.
So,
good luck.
Yeah, that's what I do.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, that's what I do. So that's what we
think about that. The fact that you know the NMLS ID number 19186 means there's something else you don't know. That is a book on the shelf of knowledge.
Is it a zero sum game, really?
Yes.
For everything new that I learned, do I have to forget things? Because that is happening.
Only so much room.
Oh my God, it's so true.
It does feel that way.
I cannot remember. For the last couple of weeks, I figured out what the problem was.
Yeah.
But for the last couple of weeks, I couldn't remember anybody's name, including my own sometimes.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was all falling in. I thought, okay, you know, the problem is I'm like absorbing too much new information. I'm tapped out. And science does believe.
I hope so.
That there is, that one of the things that happens when people get older and they get forgetful,
uh-huh,
you're full up, essentially.
And but you're smart, is,
yeah,
what it is.
And that's what it is.
I wish you could self-select the things you want to just forget.
Right,
you
right.
know, just pull those out and
you
bring in some new stuff.
You just have to buy some more Apple space in the cloud. And
that's what I'm going to do.
Insert it.
Well, I think part of it, too, is you spend so much of your time now laying things off on your phone. right? That you, I'll get to that later.
Right. And you haven't committed it
and
to...
And you don't commit it to memory because you know you can find it somewhere else. And whatever that mechanic is it is a little bit lost. So you're like, oh, I'll find it on the phone. So it's like, I'll figure out somebody's name by the phone. But I need that facial recognition thing.
But have you guys done this? And we're broadcasters, so maybe more us than people listening. But have you looked up at a person that you're talking to, about to interview or introduce, and you go, I don't have the name. Don't have the name.
Every day that happens.
Who is this person?
Thanks for coming in, bud.
Yeah, exactly. So here's the news with... my buddy,
who's
Ticker Wade?
Who's the girl in the traffic?
Emma. That's hard to forget.
It's kind of hard to forget. Violetta's very
come
unforgettable.
On, traffic, hun. Take it away.
Oh, yeah, that traffic works. Hun.
You know what? That was
traffic, honey.
Yeah, that was, you know, Les Moonves used to call them that. I like how that worked.
I think several broadcasting executives over the years.
All right, anything you want to promo before you go?
Let me just say, you know what? Let me just mention this. We're going to have a guy in this first hour. It's a Chicago story concerning 9/11. This is it was a volunteer firefighter, and within hours of the towers going down, he was on his way to New York and spent, and never slept, never showered, didn't do anything, threw himself right into it with the other volunteer firefighters that were coming from all over the nation. And he has the most amazing story to tell. He's a Chicago businessman now, an incredible success story in his own right.
Wow.
But what he did just on that day and that the weeks following September 11th, 2001, is a story that will make you very proud, not only to be an American, but also a Chicagoan.
Nice.
We're going to be listening, bud. Have a good show.
All right. Thanks very much.